takes place July 19th from 3 to 11 p.m. at Bayfront Festival Park in Duluth, Minnesota. Headliners include Jamaican reggae and dance hall artists Romaine Virgo, Charlie Black, and Kenyatta Hill, with culture Nigerian Afrobeats artist Timia. Local favorite Woodblind meets T. Galexi and DJ Sound of Fusion from Trinidad. Tickets and more info available online at bayfrontworldmusic.com.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and on the web at kfai.org. Radio without boundaries.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours: gun violence. For centuries, we've attempted to balance the right to bear arms and all the dangers that come with it through regulation. But in the last three decades, that balance has shifted. The gun has become enshrined as a political symbol in America, one that simultaneously represents our most cherished values: freedom, democracy, individualism.
We're all familiar with the old saying, God created man and Colonel Colt made us equal.
As well as our deepest shame.
Freedom isn't free. That's 133 deaths a day.
So how did we get here? And can we ever find a way forward? I'm Garrett Graff, and from Longlead and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, this is Long Shadow in Guns We Trust.
That is today on Miniculture Presents, KFEI's audio and documentary showcase program, here every Monday at 1 o'clock. Thanks for joining us. I'm your curator, Michael Whetstone. Today, for the entire hour, we're featuring the documentary In Guns We Trust from the Edward R. Murrow award-winning program, Long Shadow. This was produced in 2024 and reported and narrated by journalist, historian, and author Garrett M. Graff. In Guns We Trust recounts how firearms went from being an ordinary part of American rural life to a menacing element of modern society. The April 1999 massacre at Columbine High School hurtled the United States into an era of mass shootings that we have yet to come out of. Now, a quarter century later, the horrors of that day have become an almost regular facet of American life. But the U.S. was not always like this. Today's program will look at how did we get here and can we ever find a way forward. Be warned, it is a difficult listen and too grim for trigger warning puns or jokes, but make no doubt, there will absolutely be discussions of guns and gun violence throughout this entire hour. We featured not too long ago another program by Long Shadow, or Long Lead as they're also sometimes known. That was called The Rise of the American Far Right. It was also a difficult listen, but fascinating nonetheless. For more information on today's show, you can visit longlead.com. You can also find other stories from Long Lead in your podcast feeds or by visiting longleadpodcast.com.
If you listened to season one of Long Shadow, you know that I've spent much of the last decade reporting and writing about 9/11. Today, more than a third of America is too young to remember that day. And I've been particularly interested in the generation raised in the shadow of that tragedy. Children born in the late 90s and early 2000s, known today as Gen Z. Before demographers, researchers, and the media settled on that moniker, Gen Z was also known as the Homelanders, a phrase that denoted how their childhoods were shaped by the post-9/11 era of homeland security and the war on terror.
This just in, you are looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers.
Back in the fall of 2020, I set out to interview some of those kids, specifically children born on September 11th, 2001 itself, about their childhoods, lives, dreams, fears, and aspirations. People like Lily, a three-sport varsity athlete in high school who was starting as a communications major at the University of Rhode Island, and Dylan, a first-year computer science major at Virginia Tech. They were eligible that fall to vote for the first time in a presidential election, and I was curious about how they saw their country. It's fair to say they'd experienced something of a raw deal in American history, coming of age not just amid the war on terror, but also living through the 2008 financial crisis and then graduating from high school right into the COVID pandemic. But across the hours of interviews I did that fall, I learned that for many of them, the moment that had cast the biggest shadow on their childhood was not 9/11. Their 9/11, the moment that in their lives changed everything, their "where were you when" moment, came on December 14th, 2012, a few months after their 11th birthdays. It was the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut. For Chloe, the biracial daughter of a Philippine immigrant and a California mom in Utah, it was the first big news event she remembers. Hillary, an aspiring EMT, went to school just 25 minutes away and remembers her school going into lockdown. Lily's school added fences and locked campus doors. Tawny, a bioscience student in Virginia Beach, said she often thought about the shooting while in school. She told me, "Every time I was in a classroom, I would always make sure I knew where my exits were, and I always had a plan for what I would do if someone came into the room posing a threat. My dad would sit me down. Here's what you're going to do if this happens. And we'd talk about all these different situations and how I would be safe." Gen Z has come of age in an era of a different kind of war on terror, the war over guns. The reality is that since September 11th, 2001, jihadists have killed 107 people in the United States. During that same time, mass shootings killed more than 10 times that number. And from 2001 to 2022, firearms killed more than 775,000 Americans. The perpetrators of those mass shootings fit a clear profile. They're almost always men, angry, usually white, sometimes young, sometimes old. The truth is that this Gen Z, raised on the internet and often looked down on for their fragility, their political correctness, their obsession with inclusivity, has been forged in an age of school lockdowns and active shooter drills unimaginable to previous generations. Now, as they've reached their teens and 20s, they've reinvigorated the gun safety movement, helping to build a ubiquitous, grassroots, national effort to combat gun violence. A movement which, for the first time in decades, appears to be making meaningful progress. A movement that seems capable of drowning out the once dominating voice of America's seemingly unstoppable gun lobby. There have been more than 400 school shootings since Columbine in 1999, according to a tally by the Washington Post. In the days following a mass shooting, survivors and grieving families are usually met with an outpouring of sympathy and support from across the country. Often, they'll receive phone calls or messages from members of a growing network of gun violence survivors. People like Frank DeAngelis or Mr. D.
And I usually say, you know, this is Frank DeAngelis, and I was a principal at Columbine High School, and I'm just here to help you, whatever you need. And I said, you know, at times, this isn't going to be a one-time phone call. I'm going to be there every step of the way if someone was there for me.
After the shooting at Columbine, Mr. D had received a similar call himself from the principal of a high school in Paducah, Kentucky, that had also experienced a mass shooting in 1997. It was a call that proved more useful than Mr. D could have imagined. Amid his grief and shock, he found he had lots of practical questions.
I said, what did you do for your first graduation? What did you do for this? And I can remember saying, I'm hoping that I never have to make a phone call like Bill did to me. And I said, I just joined a club in which no one wants to be a member.
For more than two decades since that call, Mr. D has tried to pay that kindness forward by traveling to meet with other survivors and offering any help he can give. He retired from his role as Columbine's principal in 2014, fulfilling a promise to stay long enough to graduate every student in the community touched by the massacre. From there, the work with other survivors became his main focus. He helped co-found a program called the Principal Recovery Network in 2019.
Every year, we get a chance to go up and meet with legislators to talk about school safety. But at the same time, we reach out to these communities that have gone through it.
Like Columbine, the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary was another watershed moment for the country. 20 children and 6 adults killed at the school by a 20-year-old gunman with an AR-15. Sandy Phillips lost her daughter, Jessie, just 5 months earlier in Aurora, Colorado. She visited Newtown personally to meet with some of the parents.
We were in a community center that they brought some of the families to. And we didn't have to be told who they were. You could tell just by looking at them, the shock that they were in, almost like a zombie walk, you know, where are we, what are we doing? Just total shell shock.
In the aftermath of Sandy Hook, advocates for gun reform and gun violence survivors, from Columbine to Virginia Tech to Aurora, hoped that this would be the moment that might finally spur action from Congress. The moment where lawmakers might finally do more than tweet those familiar words, thoughts, and prayers. How could it not be? Most of the victims at Sandy Hook were first graders, 6- and 7-year-olds, killed within minutes by a weapon of war. The teachers who died that day gave their lives trying to protect their kids. How could this not be the moment things changed? Overnight, more than 200,000 people signed an online petition calling for stricter gun regulations. The shootings in Aurora and Newtown, just months apart, had sparked a renewed focus on background check loopholes and the expired federal ban on so-called assault weapons. In response, President Obama promised to act.
This week, I called on Congress to take up and pass common sense legislation that has the support of a majority of the American people, including banning the sale of military-style assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition clips, and making sure criminals can't take advantage of legal loopholes to get their hands on a gun.
The push for federal regulation sparked an immediate backlash from gun rights proponents.
Since when did the gun automatically become a bad word? A gun in the hands of a Secret Service agent protecting our president isn't a bad word. A gun in the hands of a soldier protecting the United States of America isn't a bad word. And when you hear your glass breaking at 3 a.m. and you call 911, you won't be able to pray hard enough for a gun in the hands of a good guy to get there fast enough to protect you.
But in the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting, the words felt more hollow. The problem wasn't the people. The problem was the guns. Few Americans felt that reaction more acutely than Chris Murphy. Murphy had spent 6 years as a congressman from Connecticut and had just weeks earlier been elected as the state's junior U.S. senator. He had heard about the shooting while he was at a train station, waiting to take his children into New York City to look at Christmas decorations. He left his family to go into New York without him and headed directly for Newtown. Within hours, he was meeting grieving families, teachers, and devastated first responders. who had seen horrors that they could never forget. That day in 2012 changed his career.
I'm pretty embarrassed by the fact that I didn't work on the issue of gun violence prior to Sandy Hook. When somebody would confront me on the issue of guns, I probably gave some answer that dodged the question, said that the problem wasn't guns, the problem was the person firing the gun.
Murphy would be sworn into the Senate just weeks after the attack. He had campaigned on causes like education, environmental advocacy, and healthcare. But after Sandy Hook, he had a new item on his agenda.
There's no doubt that, you know, that day began the rest of my life.
But a week after he was sworn in, Murphy received another unexpected wake-up call, this time at a community center in Hartford, a city whose residents are mostly Black and Latino. He was met there by advocates and survivors who had long suffered because of gun violence in their city.
And they were furious, furious. They said, listen, we understand everything that these families in Newtown are going through, but where the hell have you been? What have you been doing? What about all the Black kids in Hartford that have been getting shot year after year?
These families had been fighting against gun violence for years and felt they'd been dismissed or worse, ignored. Murphy grew up just minutes away from Hartford in Wethersfield, Connecticut, where his mom had been a public school teacher. But he says this was the first time he realized what had been happening in his own backyard, when he was called out by these families, now his constituents. So when he went to work, Murphy wanted to represent all Connecticut communities impacted by gun violence on a daily basis. Murphy began advocating for a bill that would require background checks for firearm sales at gun shows, the gun show loophole that had allowed the shooters at Columbine to purchase their guns a quarter century ago, the same gun show loophole lawmakers had been trying to close since the 1990s. Now, it was an ambitious and humbling push coming from a freshman senator still learning how to get to the Senate floor in the Capitol.
It was just a ridiculous position to be in. I was literally introducing myself to my colleagues and then lobbying them on the most controversial thing they were going to vote on that year.
But not even the horror of first graders gunned down at school was enough to spur Congress to protect Americans. The legislation was promptly watered down and ultimately received only 54 out of the 60 votes necessary.
We failed pretty badly, and what I realized was that wasn't that we were losing the argument or that our argument wasn't good enough. It's that we just lacked political power as a movement.
That failure to act after Sandy Hook disillusioned many gun violence survivors and gun regulation advocates. If even this did not prompt change, what would?
As I said from the start, no single piece of legislation can stop every act of violence and evil. We learned that tragically just 2 days ago. But if action by Congress could have saved one person, one child, a few hundred, a few thousand, if it could have prevented those people from losing their lives to gun violence in the future while preserving our Second Amendment rights, we had an obligation to try.
For years, it seemed like nothing would change. Nothing would give. Guns would be a permanent, uniquely American problem. Politicians would offer thoughts and prayers, but nothing more. But looking back now, more than a decade later, it's clear that Sandy Hook did change the country, that in ways that weren't initially visible, that shooting marked the beginning of a new wave of activism, a rising gun safety movement. One that finally could organize and take on the powerful gun lobby that had dominated the debate for decades. The day after the shooting at Sandy Hook, a Facebook group was created that would soon grow into the grassroots organization Moms Demand Action.
A day of action across the country today as mothers demanded changes to our nation's gun laws.
Then, less than a month later, Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords founded an organization to combat gun violence, what would later become the Giffords Law Center. Giffords herself had survived a mass shooting in 2011. She'd been meeting with constituents in the parking lot of a supermarket when she was shot in the head.
January 8th, 2011 changed my life forever. I founded a group called Giffords. We're on a mission to end gun violence.
17 others were shot too, six of whom died, including a 9-year-old girl named Christina Taylor Green, who had been born on September 11th, 2001. In 2013, some of the parents of children killed in Newtown founded the Sandy Hook Promise Foundation and the Sandy Hook Promise Action Fund. And notably, philanthropists like Michael Bloomberg contributed significantly to the gun violence prevention cause. In 2013, Bloomberg combined his nonprofit Mayors Against Illegal Guns with Moms Demand Action to create a new nonprofit called Every Town for Gun Safety. That group, Every Town, eventually provided seed money for the nonprofit newsroom The Trace, which was created to cover gun violence and collaborated with us on this season. And Every Town is still a significant funder of the nonprofit newsroom. Bloomberg also dedicated $50 million to lobbying for gun regulations on the state and federal level. The goal at the time, grow its membership to more than 2.5 million Americans and beat the NRA. In 2013, Obama put forth a proposal for gun control. It was a list of executive actions and possible congressional legislation that included reinstating the federal ban on America's favorite gun, the AR-15, a gun also seemingly favored by mass shooters. Altogether, these groups threatened for the first time since the 1990s to pose a formidable challenge to the gun lobby, particularly with the help of the White House and deeply committed allies in Congress, like Senator Chris Murphy.
We needed to grow a movement that eventually would be just as powerful as the NRA. And what we figured out, slowly but surely, after 2013, was, in fact, there was enormous political gain to be had by being really publicly out front in favor of things like universal background checks and assault weapons bans. And the reason is pretty simple. People want to know that you connect emotionally to the things that matter most to them. And there's nothing that matters more to any family in America than the physical safety of their children.
As this new alliance built, Murphy found that much of his work was focused outside the Capitol, meeting with advocates, hosting community conversations, and trying to find common ground for reform. Then, in 2016, came another pivotal moment.
America is just now coming to grips with what unfolded here in the early morning hours here in Orlando, a massacre at a gay nightclub, and at the center of it all, a lone gunman who, in the middle of that massacre, called 911 to pledge allegiance to ISIS.
A gunman killed 49 people and wounded 53 others at Pulse, an LGBTQ nightclub in Orlando, Florida. At the time, it was the deadliest mass shooting the country had ever seen. It was targeted and planned, and shockingly, the shooter had once been on an FBI watch list. For Murphy, it was a moment where he felt forced to step outside the normal routine and pattern of grief the country had come to expect following yet another massacre.
Both parties would come out in the hours afterwards and declare their thoughts and prayers aligned with the victims. Democrats would create a kerfuffle about policy change. Republicans would say no. And within about 48 to 72 hours, everything would be back to normal. It had become a script by 2016. And I got on the phone with my staff that weekend that Pulse happened, and we walked through that script and the role that I was going to play in that script, and I just couldn't do it. I had to do something to change the script, to force people in the country and my colleagues to confront the cost of inaction.
So instead of following the script, Murphy and his colleagues, Senators Cory Booker and Richard Blumenthal, came up with a plan. They would shut down the Senate by launching a filibuster.
We've got to find a way to come together. Now, I don't know how long this will take, but I'm going to stand here and continue to hold the floor while we give time for our colleagues to try to figure out a path forward to recognize that without changes in this nation's gun laws, supported by the vast majority of Americans, that this slaughter will continue.
The goal was to force a vote on two proposed amendments to an appropriations bill. The first would ban anyone on a government watch list from purchasing firearms, and the second would expand background checks.
I remember texting my wife right before I went down to the floor. I think I'm about to make a giant mistake because I worried that I was going to be like a tree falling in the woods. You know, I was going to stand up on the floor and declare that I wasn't giving it up until we had a vote on background checks and nobody was going to care. But that's not what happened.
Ultimately, 40 of Murphy's colleagues would join him over the nearly 15-hour-long filibuster, one of the longest in U.S. history. The stand reverberated far beyond the Capitol, and the real impact could be seen on Twitter as the hashtag filibuster trended and video clips of Murphy spread online. Thousands of supportive calls poured into Murphy's office, and the filibuster appeared to provide a much-needed jolt to the gun safety movement. In the end, not surprisingly, both amendments failed. That was to be expected. But people sensed a change in the national dialogue. Perhaps the momentum was shifting. A week later, a group of House representatives, inspired by the filibuster in the Senate, held a sit-in that once again commanded the nation's attention. With the support of Congressman John Lewis, the sit-in drew some 170 lawmakers.
And what I think happened between the filibuster and the sit-in is that the movement and just a whole bunch of regular people out there realized that we didn't have to be on defense all the time. We could go on offense.
That offensive approach really began to coalesce in 2018 after the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where 17 students were killed and 17 others were injured. The students in Parkland had watched shooting after shooting trend in hashtags on social media. Now they themselves became the hashtag. And just as they were also reaching voting age, they were informed, politically engaged, and they were angry. Almost overnight, a group of student survivors from Parkland became some of the most vocal and visible activists of the modern gun safety movement.
And it's time for Congress to listen. Our message is clear. No more silence. End gun violence. No more silence.
They spoke out in interviews. They organized. They protested. They were featured on the cover of Time magazine. On March 14, 2018, just a month after the Parkland shooting, nearly a million kids across the country, inspired by the survivors, walked out of their classrooms to protest the epidemic of school shootings. A 17-minute walkout for the 17 lives lost at Parkland. Then, 10 days later, they helped organize and lead the inaugural March for Our Lives. And more than 800,000 people attended the rally in Washington, D.C., an impressive organizing feat for a group of newly committed activists who just 6 weeks earlier had been ordinary high school students. Enough is enough, they chanted.
When politicians send their thoughts and prayers with no action, we say no more. And to those politicians supported by the NRA that allow the continued slaughter of our children and our future, I say get your resumes ready. We will come together. We will get rid of these public servants that only serve the gun lobby. And we will save lives.
This is also when the movement started to expand further toward more bipartisan support, as Gen Z Republicans began to diverge from the party on the issue of guns. The New York Times reported that in 2018, gun safety lobbying groups had for the first time outspent the NRA in the midterm elections. In eight close congressional contests, Democrats emphasized gun reform while running against Republican incumbents with an A rating from the NRA. And in all eight races, the Democrat won.
once Democrats started really leading on the issue of guns, and this really started to happen in 2017 and 2018, we started winning all sorts of unexpected races, including eventually, a place like Georgia. And that was, I think what I learned was that the conventional wisdom on guns had just been wrong. This has now become one of the few litmus test issues inside the Democratic Party. There is no way you can win a serious contest to be a Democratic nominee for anything unless you are for universal background checks and a ban on assault weapons. That is brand new in this country and brand new to Democratic politics. And I'm fascinated by how quickly that conventional wisdom has changed.
In 2018, at long last, it seemed the nation's sense of what was reasonable when it came to gun rights was changing. After decades of watching the Second Amendment move to the fore of American life, as the country weighed questions of individual rights and community safety, perhaps America didn't have to live like this forever. More after the break.
The Vietnam veterans were committing suicide, something like 19 per day. I don't think that suicide rate has dropped with the newer veterans.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is David Hansen. I was in the United States Air Force. I went to Vietnam for a year in 69. I almost committed suicide. I had three attempts at suicide. Two of them I never told my wife. I sat on the kitchen floor. I had that knife in my hand. I couldn't face the fact of my wife waking up and finding me dead on the kitchen floor. I happened to see my wife's computer on the counter. I opened it up and I looked for the suicide hotline. The thought of suicide is not that it's just harming yourself, it's harming everybody else you leave behind. What are those people going to do without you?
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. This is Mini Culture Presents, and today we are listening to the documentary In Guns We Trust from the Edward R. Murrow Award-winning program Long Shadow. For more information on today's show, you can visit longlead.com. And if you'd like to hear more from them, simply search for Long Lead in your podcast app or visit longshadowpodcast.com. Today's episode is sort of a compression or summary of their entire third season. So if you would like to dive deeper, I strongly suggest you visit them. There are about 5 hours covering this material. You can find them all at longshadowpodcast.com. We now continue with our story, In Guns We Trust, here on KFAI.
In 2022, the youngest survivors of Parkland graduated from high school, and the oldest graduated college. It was then, 4 years after their high school shooting, after countless other shootings, that their hopes for change finally came to fruition. Congress finally passed the first major federal gun reform bill in nearly 30 years, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. But it only happened after yet another tragedy, a shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, that spring.
Very, very sad news coming out there in Texas right now, as all thoughts and prayers are for these families and friends of the victims right now. We continue to await for an update from police officials there at the scene.
Like at Sandy Hook, most of the Uvalde victims were young children, just 10 years old. Over the nearly quarter century since Columbine, America had weathered all too many mass shootings. Many of the deadliest we have not even mentioned. A Las Vegas music concert, a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, a workplace shooting in San Bernardino, a Walmart in El Paso. America had seemingly gotten used to these tragedies, but it quickly became clear in 2022 that Uvalde was different. The story that emerged about the police response was not only shocking, but for many, unconscionable. Some of the first officers who arrived on the scene at Robb Elementary entered the school right away, but then retreated after they were fired upon. And instead of going back in, they waited and waited. They waited for officers with more equipment to arrive. One mother, confounded by their inaction, actually hopped a fence and ran into the school herself to help her son's escape before police did.
Nothing was being done. If anything, they were being more aggressive on us parents that were willing to go in there. And like I told one of the officers, I don't need your protection. If anything, I need you to go in there with me to go protect my kids.
Altogether, more than 370 law enforcement officers responded to the attack, including the U.S. Border Patrol, U.S. Marshals, Texas State Troopers, local police, even the school district's own police force. But they all held back, hundreds of officers. It took law enforcement officers 77 minutes to confront and kill the shooter. By the end, 19 fourth graders and two teachers were dead. Something had clearly gone terribly wrong. Was it a miscommunication? A failure of leadership? A lack of training? Yes. But there was also more. Soon, some of the officers would admit that they hadn't entered the classroom with the gunman for a much simpler reason. They were scared of his gun, an AR-15. A battle rifle, one officer called it. Later, the official report from the Department of Justice found one critical error at the heart of the failed response. Law enforcement in Uvalde had followed protocol for a barricade or hostage situation, the same mistake made at Columbine High School more than two decades ago. They should have followed the active shooter protocols, which were changed drastically since 1999. When facing a barricaded suspect or a hostage situation, negotiation is sometimes possible, but you can't negotiate with a mass shooter who aims primarily to kill. It wasn't the first time that police had failed to stop a school shooting. Famously, the school resource officer at Parkland had also failed to engage the gunman there. But Uvalde was a moment that seemed to subvert so much of the NRA's longtime rhetoric. The good guys with guns, hundreds of them, had only managed to save themselves. The community and national outrage was immediate. One of the teachers, who lost all 11 of his students in the shooting and was himself wounded three times, called law enforcement cowards.
Did you feel abandoned in that moment by police, by the people who are supposed to protect you?
Absolutely. After everything, I get more angry because you have a bulletproof vest. I had nothing. You're supposed to protect and serve. There is no excuse for their actions. And I will never forgive them. I will never forgive them.
President Biden spoke to the country in a national address. He said that other countries have mental health problems, domestic disputes, and people who are lost. But he said these kinds of mass shootings never happen with the kind of frequency they happen in America.
Why? Why are we willing to live with this carnage? Why do we keep letting this happen? Where in God's name is our backbone?
It was enough to tip the scales. The Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, or BSCA, passed in June 2022, just 1 month after the massacre at Uvalde, demonstrating just how quickly Congress can act when motivated. It was a bittersweet moment for the gun safety movement.
It happened for a number of reasons, but again, I think the primary one is that during those 30 days, the anti-gun violence movement made more noise than the gun lobby did.
There were five major changes included in the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. It provided funding to implement so-called red flag laws and enhanced background checks for gun buyers under the age of 21. It expanded the meaning of gun dealer to include smaller dealers, not just people who own a gun store. It narrowed the so-called boyfriend loophole, preventing more domestic abusers from having a gun. And it allocated more than $13 billion to support mental health programs, improve school safety models, and fund violence interruption programs in urban areas. After more than a decade working on the gun issue, Murphy finally had some good news to share. There was only one thing left to do. Alone in his Hartford home the night before the bill was going to pass, Murphy picked up the phone. Here's Murphy describing that night to the Trace's managing director, James Burnett, at the Texas Tribune Festival in 2023.
I sat down at my big dining room table with the list of the families from Sandy Hook and the families from Bridgeport and the families from Columbine. And I just started calling them to tell them what was about to happen the next day, right? That first time in 30 years, we were going to pass something to honor the loss of your child.
He heard plenty of anger. Why did it take so long? Why wasn't Sandy Hook or Aurora or Virginia Tech the wake-up call? But he also heard gratitude and a determination to continue the fight.
You know, there's a lot of hurt being a part of this movement, but I think there's going to be a lot more days like that, and that's what sort of keeps me coming back to this.
Murphy says there's been a reduction in gun violence since the bill's passing. According to preliminary data, urban homicides dropped nationally by as much as 12% from 2022 to 2023. Though it's hard to pinpoint exactly what factors have caused the reduction, Murphy feels certain the bill has had more than a little impact.
It's just continued proof that when you change the laws, good things happen, more people are alive. I think it often takes some time for immovable political infrastructure to catch up with public opinion. But one way or another, we are passing the laws that will be necessary to get a dramatic decline in gun violence in this country. I am 100% confident that we are passing universal background checks and a ban on assault weapons in the next 5 to 10 years. I am 100% confident of that. I think this country has made up its mind. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when.
But even as gun reform progressed, gun rights continued to expand as well. In 2022, the same year Congress passed the BSCA, the country saw another landmark moment, the most important Supreme Court ruling on gun rights since 2008. The case, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin, overturned New York State's concealed carry permitting law and set off a string of challenges to similar laws across the country. And, for the first time, it established the right to carry firearms in public for self-defense. So for many gun safety proponents, it's clear a lot of work still lies ahead. The BSCA was just the start. Every Town for Gun Safety analyzed gun crime data from 31 police departments, and its researchers found that in 2021, more than 50% of crime guns recovered by police were produced by just four major gun manufacturers: Glock, Smith & Wesson, Taurus, and Ruger. But for the most part, gun manufacturers aren't often held liable for the day-to-day toll of gun violence on American society. And there's another change that gun safety proponents believe would have a massive impact on the public's understanding of the links between the gun makers and the violence on our streets: repealing the TEART amendment. Though news reports often mention the kind of gun used in a high-profile shooting, they often don't name the manufacturer, And that's not an accident. The 2003 amendment, named for Kansas Representative Todd Tiart, prohibits the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF, from releasing information about guns linked to a criminal investigation directly to the public. Once Tiart was passed, gun trace data could only be shared directly with law enforcement. It aimed to preserve the integrity of criminal investigations and to protect a firearms dealer from being blamed, or worse, potentially sued if their product was used in a crime. The Tiart Amendment also required the FBI to destroy successful background check records within 24 hours, and the process for tracing a gun used in a crime back to its original owner is nothing short of Kafkaesque.
That's probably a surprise for most people who watch CSI or Law & Order, and somebody's just typing something into a computer terminal, and boom, the gun trace comes up. That's not how things work in real life at all. When it comes to guns, everything is stuck in the 1970s.
Jennifer Massia has been my co-reporter on this season of Long Shadow. Jen walked us through the way gun tracing works in real life. So let's say a police officer finds a gun at the scene of a crime or in connection to a criminal investigation. In order to track down the owner of that gun and locate a potential suspect, they first call the ATF and provide a serial number. Then,
an ATF investigator picks up the phone and calls the serial number into the gun manufacturer. The gun manufacturer furnishes the name of the wholesaler.
Like with most consumer products, gun manufacturers don't sell directly to the public. They sell to a wholesaler, who then sells inventory to a gun dealer, who then sells it to a civilian customer.
So the ATF investigator calls the wholesaler, and the wholesaler will furnish the name of the gun store it was sold to. So the ATF investigator calls the gun store and gives the gun store the serial number. The gun store takes out its notebook, called a bound book, or Excel file sometimes, where they've recorded the sales information.
But we're not done just yet. The gun seller then matches the serial number to the corresponding background check form, which is kept on file by the dealer on site.
And it's paper, mostly. It's paper and pencil.
Then, finally, the ATF investigator gets a name that he can share with the police officer who made the original request.
That's a process that should take 3 seconds typing something into a computer, and it can take up to 2 weeks.
And there's another possibility. What if the dealer that sold the weapon is no longer in business? In that case, all of the dealer's old records are handed over to the ATF.
In West Virginia, there is a facility that has more than 900 million paper records. They fill 40 cargo shipping containers with 2,000 boxes each of paper that the ATF has to find a way to go through. And they can't just catalog this in a digital file anywhere. So when the inventories come in, the ATF will take a picture of every page. They can't search for keywords. The tracing center staffers have created a system for physically locating the right record. It's almost like the Dewey Decimal System on steroids. And that takes time. And you see where gun rights are starting to hamper law enforcement.
And all of that, mind you, is the best case scenario. If the gun was purchased through a private sale, there might not be any paperwork at all.
So if you have somebody who's committing multiple crimes, they're free to commit more crimes with that gun while somebody's going through the trace.
Repealing the Tiart Amendment would at the very least bring the ATF's gun tracing process into the 21st century. And here's why all of this is important. Gun trace information could not only help solve more crimes faster, it could also provide important insights into who commits gun violence and how they access firearms, which could tell us a lot about the effectiveness of current regulations. Because the reality is, there's still a lot we don't know about how to regulate this industry and how to best effectively reduce gun violence. Frankly, the ATF is a dark box. Gun sales records and inventories are not tracked by the FBI. We don't even know precisely how many Americans own guns or how many carry concealed weapons, or how many guns are lost or stolen each year. And in a country where we must weigh the rights of some Americans against the safety of others, data like this could have a major impact and save thousands of lives. But as slow and uncertain as it seems progress on gun reform may be, America has, perhaps, turned a corner. Today, gun safety proposals and reform efforts are increasingly bipartisan, and many proposals have broad public support. In recent years, for the first time in two decades, public health researchers are beginning to look at data-informed solutions for what works in reducing gun violence. For example, research shows that states with universal background checks have reduced rates of firearm homicide, and the Trace obtained FBI data that shows that the BSCA's enhanced background checks have successfully flagged more young gun buyers who pose a risk of harm and blocked them from purchasing firearms. We now know that temporary transfer laws, which temporarily restrict firearm access for people who pose a harm to themselves or others, lead to a reduction in state suicide rates. And laws that require secure firearm storage and penalize noncompliance reduce firearm deaths. It's clear that there's not one solution or simple fix to gun violence in the country. What matters, though, is that we seem, for the first time in decades, to be implementing any solutions at all. Those kids who grew up with school lockdowns and active shooter drills are adults now, and they've grown into some of the country's leading gun safety advocates, making sure that guns stay at the forefront of the American political debate. March for Our Lives has continued and expanded. The organization now has a youth-led judicial advocacy group and has helped push forward more than 300 new gun safety laws. Looking to the future, they hope to push for a national gun buyback program, a national gun licensing and registry system, and a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Beyond the specifics of legislation, though, that new generation is showing that you can be a national political leader on a platform of gun safety.
My name is Maxwell Alejandro Frost. I'm a survivor of gun violence and organizer, former and inaugural national organizing director for March for Our Lives, and now I'm running for Congress here in Orlando. Thank you. I'm here to tell you that a better world is possible. I'm here to tell you that we have to use every tool in our toolbox to get a world where gun violence doesn't exist. So yes, that means march. Yes, that means protest. That means vote. And we need you all to vote.
Maxwell Frost first became interested in gun violence and politics after Sandy Hook. In 2023, at 25 years old, he became the youngest member of Congress and the first Gen Z congressman. He beat a state senator and two U.S. representatives in the primary in Florida, once the nation's test kitchen for some of the most pervasive pro-gun laws. During his time in Congress, he's introduced a number of gun bills and pushed for a federal office of gun violence prevention, which President Biden then created in 2023. And it's not just in Florida. In 2023, two Democratic Tennessee representatives, Justin Jones and Justin Pearson, were expelled for violating House rules after they joined thousands of protesters at the state capitol calling for stricter gun regulations. The protest came days after a school shooting at Covenant School in Nashville. Justin Jones has called their defiance good trouble, citing the late civil rights icon, John Lewis. Later that year, the two lawmakers were returned to the GOP-dominated statehouse in a special election. It was a major coup.
I want to thank you all, not for what you did, but for awakening the people of this state, particularly the young people. Thank you for reminding us that the struggle for justice is fought and won in every generation.
Frost, Jones, and Pearson, who are all men of color in their late 20s, represent a new generation of leaders recognizing that justice, equality, and freedom for all in this country have been hard won. Leaders who believe that change is not only possible, but imminent. and that maybe, just maybe, we don't have to sacrifice safety in order to enjoy liberty. It's hard not to see in their successful stands a larger shift in our national dialogue over guns.
A lot of times people will ask me, they'll say, Frank, you know, you've been retired for 10 years, you continue to reach out and help, but these shootings continue. And my response is, but how many have been stopped because of things we're doing differently? And so we can't ever give up hope.
Long Shadow in Guns We Trust is produced by Longlead and Campside Media in collaboration with The Trace and distributed by PRX. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. The series is hosted and reported by me, Garrett Graff. It was created by myself and executive producer John Patrick Pullen of Longlead. Jennifer Massia of The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom that covers guns in America, is my co-reporter and a contributing producer for this season. The show is written by Emily Martinez. Aaliyah Papes is the associate producer and a contributing writer as well. Matthew Scher and Emily Martinez also served as executive producers on the season. Our theme song was composed by Netta Hadari. Sound design by Claire Mullen. Additional engineering by Ewan Lai Tremuen. Music by Blue Dot Sessions and APM. This episode was recorded by Joe Egan at Egan Media Productions in Colchester, Vermont, and Josh Millman at Digital One in Portland, Oregon. This episode was fact-checked by Sarah Baum, Miranda Kaplan, Aaliyah Papes, and Emily Barone. Audience development by Heather Muse. Cover art by Longlead's creative director, Sarah Rogers. Special thanks to Lindsay Kilbride, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and Jennifer Bassett, who consulted on the podcast.
That was the documentary In Guns We Trust from the award-winning program Long Shadow, produced in 2024 and reported and narrated by journalist, historian, and author Garrett M. Graff. His book, Graff's book, Watergate, A New History, Garrett M. Graff. For more information on today's show, you can visit longlead.com. And if you'd like to hear more from them, simply search for Longlead in your podcast app. They've got some very good shows, tough but important listening. And if you would like to dive deeper, I strongly suggest you visit them. Today's show was a condensed version or summary of a much longer entire season, about 5 hours of in-depth, sound-rich reporting all on this topic and very much worth listening to. This has been Mini Culture Presents, KFEI's radio and documentary showcase program, here every Monday on Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. My name is Michael Whetstone. See you here again next week. Next up, buckle up for the Upside Down.
When I am older, I will change back to the way I once was when we first set our eyes on it.
You do.